See, I got my master's, moved out here, and we stayed. So it was his first job, and we really liked living out here. So it was at that point where we started to get involved in the Jewish community here. And we found it very welcoming at that time. There were a lot of faculty who were hired at that time, which doesn't happen so much. It's not happening as much now as it did when we came in 73. But there were a large number of Jewish faculty that had just been hired. So there were a lot of young couples kind of going through the same thing as we were. Newly moved to Lawrence, teaching at the university. You know, wives who were finding jobs. Of course, it was mostly the men who had the jobs at the university at that time. And it was a very nice atmosphere. We did social things. We got to know each other quite well. And there was a range. You know, the older people who were there were really interesting older individuals. And in fact, one of the women, should I just keep going?
Yeah.
One of the women, Selma Cohn, became a really close friend. She probably was about the age of my mom. And she was just neat. She had also majored in art, went to KU. Her husband played football at KU when he went. And they were among the small number of people who started the center here. And one of the reasons for starting the center was really so that they didn't have to drive to Kansas City to take their kids to Sunday school or for religious education of any sort. And they felt that they needed something here. And I think it started in a house on Tennessee Street. I don't know which house, though. I don't know if you know that.
No, I don't know that, huh?
Yeah, David Katzman probably does.
Probably. I'll see if I can find that out.
Yeah, it was a house on Tennessee Street, and it was in the, was it the 50s or the 60s, when they had the money to build the building where it is now on Highland Drive, except that it was just the small brick part of the building. So there were several classrooms and sanctuary upstairs. It's exactly like it was back then. Maybe new carpet and paint, but pretty much the same same layout. And I think there was a big open room, but it wasn't that big. I guess there weren't very many classrooms back then. And then the addition was put on about 1980. And we got a call from someone. We were on sabbatical in Chapel Hill, and somebody called and said, well, we're putting on an addition. How much money can you give us? So that's the only reason I remember the date. I'm really bad with remembering dates, but I know that that's the year we were away. And it was Herman, Selma's husband, who put the building on. And this is, it's really a funny story. I don't know if we've ever talked about that. Herman ran a junk shop here in town. His uncle started it. And you know, years ago, Jews were merchants. I mean, and they had wagons and they sold stuff, you know, just junk, basically. But they always called it was Herman's Junk Shop. And he had, it was a crazy place. It was like, the hardware store downtown, how old it is, and they know where everything is. Mm-hmm. Well, it was sort of like that, but more like a garage. And he knew where everything was. But if you needed an old, you know, an engine to fit something, he could find it for you. He could fix it. He could fix anything. He was really pretty incredible that way. I think he had majored in geology, but he didn't really do much with it. He went into his uncle's business and ran that until he retired. But he was the impetus for getting the addition put on the building. And whether there was a committee or not, I'm not quite sure. I think there were some people that worked with him, but he simply put up this tin sort of a barn-like building, and it was empty. And he said, this is when I returned from Chapel Hill, I remember him saying, well, you come out the door here, and this is where you enter the building, and we'll put the kitchen here, and then we'll put the bathrooms, and then we'll... So he was basically walking across this great big room and just putting things as he moved. And they actually put the plumbing in for a kitchen that didn't anywhere meet code because it was on the wrong side of the building. And they had to tear that out and put it back in again. It was interesting. I mean, it was sort of like he just decided we needed more space, which we did. But they didn't get an architect. He had notes on a little piece of paper and would say, well, Herman, where does this go? And he'd pull out his little piece of paper and said, well, I think that's over here. And so it's very interesting. But the building did go up. We did get an architect. He made a number of changes in the plan. There was no plan for a staircase, but there was a second floor. And I said, well, how come we're not having a staircase in this plan? And one of the committee members said, well, you know how we are. We change our mind about everything. So if we don't put the stairs in now, or if we put the stairs in now, someone's going to want to move them in a year or two. And I said, that's not really the way to do this. So we did put stairs. Those stairs are still there. And now we are wanting to, in fact, the congregation just voted last weekend to have a $2 million campaign to really fix the building up, to do a major renovation, which would include fixing what is our social hall and increasing the size of the sanctuary upstairs, and then making the building handicapped accessible. It's not been, and the community is aging, or at least it has a number of people who are quite a bit older. So we've moved services downstairs into the social hall, and then some people are happy with it, some people are not. But we really need to make the building accessible. So that was the starting point. Everybody wanted to make the building accessible. And it's a fairly expensive endeavor to put an elevator in. So we just went the whole route. I actually missed the meeting because I was out of town and never expected that the community would vote for the whole thing. I thought that they'd go halfway. You know, the halfway meant making it handicapped accessible and putting the elevator in, making some changes in the entryway. Some cosmetic things would have been done, but we wouldn't have increased the size of the sanctuary. And some things would have just been put in different places. But they went for the whole thing. I think it's because the architect did a really good job of presenting a plan that looks so nice that how could you just go halfway? So I figured that's probably why they did that. So what else can I say about the community?
Well, lots of different ways we can go. You mentioned that the community is aging. What's the status of young people? Are young people coming in?
You know, it's interesting. There are a few young couples who have, and some single people who have joined the congregation. We've got a bunch of little babies who were there, which is always my measure. You know, we've got children coming in. That's a good sign. It's not the same as it was, how long ago, 35 years ago. More people came to services on Friday nights. We don't do a Saturday morning service because we just don't have enough people to make a minyan, which is we need to have 10. We count women so we can have 10 people, adults, at services. And then you can say certain prayers that you don't say if you don't have the minyan. You can have service, but there are certain things that are left out. And that's always been a problem, and I think it's not an unusual problem across the country because, we don't live in a Jewish world, so you've got soccer practice and piano lessons and dance lessons and all these things that children participate in that keep people from really participating fully in some of the religious aspects. And that's, you know, it's just the way it is. Let's see. We were talking about, oh, the ages. Well, I'm trying to think. There's always been a wide range of ages. That older generation is now just about gone. The generation that the older people, when I moved here, have pretty much passed on. I mean, there were a couple who moved to California and then they, you know, passed away there. The couple I was telling you about went to Israel and made Aliyah and lived there for their last years. And Selma just died this past fall, and she was 94. So that was, I mean, that's just sad, especially because it's the end of that generation. And then I look around and I think, there are only a few people between me and that generation. And then there are younger people. But they're not, I don't think there are as many. And then our Sunday school always had about 40 children, and we've really dropped off.
Is that right?
Yeah. So we maybe have 13 to 15 enrolled this year, which is a concern. And it's interesting. It's hard to find Jewish professionals who live in Lawrence. I mean, there are people in Kansas City, but they don't want to travel here to work, and it's not a full-time job. So it's hard to find people. Oftentimes we have students who have gone to a religious day school, and so they have a very good background and they fill in, or adults in the community. I did the religious school when I was younger. I taught kindergarten classes. And I think a lot of the people my age did participate in teaching. And right now, I think we have one adult from the community who's teaching in the Sunday school, and it's mostly students from KU. So we have Jewish students. But we had some issues with the religious school director, and we felt we were lucky to find an adult woman from Kansas City who was willing to come here once a week and work necessary, but she had a really good background and had a lot of experience teaching and working with curricula and the kinds of things we really needed. And we needed an adult, because it's really hard for a college student, and you probably have had some experience with this, a college student to be in charge of peers in an authoritative way, so that those peers will really listen when they tell them something. So our teachers weren't preparing any kind of lesson plans. They just come, and I don't know how they knew what to do. But so having an adult who is supervising the whole show makes a big difference. And in fact, we've had a number of people drop out this year because they were unhappy last year. And yet, the school is really doing much better. The kids are really learning more. And the feedback that I'm still on that committee, the education committee, so the feedback that I'm getting from parents with children is that they're much happier. The kids are happy. They're learning more, and things seem to be much better. But now it's an issue of getting some of those parents back on board who had pulled their kids, because it really wasn't very good. And when the kids didn't want to go, it was an argument every week. So we're going to try to get them back in, which is a bit of a concern with having this campaign for $2 million, but we'll work it out, I'm sure. Let's see.
Like every religious body everywhere, though, it sounds like it. I don't hear anything that's unusual here.
I know. I read an interesting book about Finding My Spiritual Home. Do you know it? It was written by a rabbi. I won't remember his name, but it was very interesting, and it was David Katzman who gave it. He suggested reading it, and it was someone interviewed individuals from various communities, whether they were Orthodox communities or very reformed communities, talking about how they got to the place where they were. And then there was the piece about the actual community that they were talking about and changes that they were making. And the interesting thing was that we're not very different from all these other communities. Things that we say are problems, you know, in the big cities where they have more people. And we always say, oh, it's because we're little and we live here. And it just is, things are, I think, changing. The dynamic is changing. Some young people that I've talked to, but these are young people, but in their 30s, edging up to 40. And they've said, you know, I call it iPod generation or whatever. But it's, you know, those guys don't listen, you probably don't either, listen to a whole album. You know, I was the generation who got an album. It was a record, you know, it was plastic. And we've made the switch to CDs, but we do the whole thing. And young people pick and choose and download, you know, single songs that they like from various albums, make their own playlist. And I think they look at religion the same way. They want their own playlist. So one of these couples they send their children to a Jewish day school. They do not belong to a synagogue. They go to one synagogue for some things, another synagogue. So what they're doing is picking and choosing the services from various locations to fit their personal needs. And I think at this point in time, it's very hard for at least a synagogue to be there and do what they need to do for everybody across the board. It probably isn't happening anywhere, but I'm also seeing that when I had children, my peers who had young children understood that if we wanted the kids to have any kind of religious education that would be a permanent sort of thing, that would really become part of them, that we had to do something about it. And so we became involved in Sunday school. We made sure we went to services, because if you didn't do those things, there wasn't a community of people around you like what I grew up with. So I knew I was Jewish, and if I didn't go to services, although I did go fairly often, if I didn't, I knew there was a sense of Jewishness. You knew what that was, what it meant. And if parents don't set that up in some way for their children, they just don't get it. There isn't anything there. School is very, I don't want to say Christian necessarily, but I don't think there's enough acknowledgement of the diversity that's in the community. It's not just of the Jewish population, but the Muslim population and children who are coming from other cultures. So I was on the school board for 8 years, and the number of students who do not have English as a second language, as a first language, has increased incredibly in the last, I was on, oh, like probably 6-7 years. We used to have one school that serve those children, and you need to have a balance of English speaking kids and non English speaking kids. I think we now have 4 schools in the district that serve children who have English as a second language. That's kind of diverging to some extent, but
English wasn't the first language of this continent.
Well, that's true, but we're
thinking like that.
Yeah, but it's I think it's something that we pay a lot of attention to, that because it's a language difference. But in terms of some of the cultural differences, I think that people just don't recognize that there are lots of differences. This is more on task. My daughter was in, she must have been like maybe fourth or fifth grade, probably fourth grade. And she came home from school and she said, it was right around Christmas time. And I guess I didn't hear about the art project at school, but they made decorations. They were like tin can things, and somebody punched a hole, and they put a ribbon in, and the kids painted them. So they were obvious Christmas decorations. We don't have Christmas decorations. We don't need them. We don't use them. They're pretty at somebody else's house. So she came home after they had a gift exchange at school. They don't do this anymore, but that's partly because of change in policy. But they had this gift exchange, and this child gave her one of those Christmas ornaments that they'd made in school. And the issue for me wasn't so much that it was, at that point, the Christmas ornament that she got. She was real upset because she didn't get a real present like the other kids, that she got this Christmas ornament. And my take on it was that this poor kid didn't have the resources to buy a present. So he had nothing else to give to someone but the ornament that he'd made. So if the kids had all been told to make something for an exchange, so the whole thing, and that's where I think that, you know, religion in the schools is, it just doesn't belong there. And it's a lot of that's been pulled out.
We had some Hare Krishna neighbors for some years.
Oh, did you?
At Pinckney School, and your stories, what they have to say about it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and
they were really outsiders.
Yeah. And there are kids who don't do birthday parties. And I think we just don't recognize that as a community enough. Back in the 60s when there were problems, racial problems, and they did sort of desensitizing, and they did do workshops for teachers to, you know, instruct them to educate them about different needs of different kids and diverse issues. But you get to a point where you think, oh, well, we're okay now and everybody knows this, but you get a whole new generation of teachers in who haven't had that experience and don't have those sensitivities. But so I think of that as an ongoing thing, which is not happening in an ongoing way. But it is different. I often really dislike the season. And not because I dislike it. I mean, my parents took me in to New York to see the windows when I was a kid, and there were Christmas windows. But none of it happened until Thanksgiving. And if you pay attention to what's going on in the stores now, there are Christmas trees up in the stores and all the Christmas stuff. We barely got finished with Halloween. We haven't gotten to Thanksgiving. And it just lasts so long. You know, they start playing the music, and that's all you hear on the radio. And it gets to be like that's all there is. So I mean, in terms of all, it's the commercial stuff that gets to me after a while, because you know it's only to sell more stuff. And I was in Chicago, but it's starting to look like. It's starting to look like the holiday, yeah, in the stores. And they're putting the lights up, and they were on. They put their light, I saw them putting lights up downtown last week. But they started turning them on already. So it's kind of like, oh. Macy's stores had their windows up, all their Christmas windows and decorations outside the building. So it's kind of funny sort of thing when you're not part of that people don't understand often how you feel about sort of being bombarded, but I enjoy parts of that. Don't get me wrong. I mean, you know, we used to take the kids and decorate friends' Christmas tree so they could have the experience of doing it without us having to have a Christmas tree. And it's an interesting thing because they see it and they're pretty. You know, they're all decorative and you know, their friends are putting presents under the Christmas tree and everybody. So it's nice to share those traditions with other families. And that's, I think, an important piece. But my kids grew up here. My daughter was bat mitzvah. My son was bar mitzvah. And they they're very much connected to their religious beliefs, but in different sort of ways. My son is 25 now, and he will do Friday night Shabbat dinners and have friends over. He bakes challah on Fridays, which I get a kick out of. I think it's great that he's doing that. But in terms of organized religion, doesn't interest him particularly. So he will say, well, Mom, now don't be upset if I'm not going to services for the holidays. I just don't see a need to do that. But I'm having dinner at Ari's family's house. So Ari is a friend from college, and his family always has him over for the holidays. And some holidays he used to go down to Philadelphia with a friend. And so he finds his little niches, but it's... I think organized religion is changing a lot, especially for young people. So I don't know.
Yeah,
and I think that's probably across the board.
Churches are having some issues. It's not specific to Judaism. It's everywhere. Mm-hmm. There are national statistics on these things.
Yeah.
It's real.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, I wonder. You wonder about the long term implications of it.
That's the issue there. Yeah. You know, it's kind of. I don't know. I don't know what will happen with that.
Let me shift gears a little bit to something else. What about money? You mentioned these capital fund drives, but how's it funded day to day? What kind of budget is there? Where does it come from? Where does it go?
The budget pretty much comes from dues. So members pay dues. We used to have a scale, kind of, you know, if you were... families paid a certain amount, singles paid a certain amount, retired people paid a different amount, students paid a different amount. And now what we've gone to is a percentage of income. And it's on our system. People pay what they feel they can pay or what they feel they're getting out of it.
What percentage is it now?
You know, you would ask that. I can't think. Is it 0.5% or something? It's relatively small, but 1.5%? I don't remember.
Because the dues used to be, I heard someone say, this is quite a few years ago, seems like it was somewhere in the vicinity of $1,000 for a family.
Actually, I don't think it ever got that high.
Is that right?
When it was standard, I think it was more like 700, 750. Our dues are really low. Compared to Kansas City, you probably couldn't get into a synagogue there for anywhere under 1,800. And they probably have sliding scales for people who really can't afford that. They wouldn't turn them away, but the standard dues are much higher. Depending upon your income, then. The majority of our community are either affiliated with the university, and less so for the young people. We have people who work for like Payless or some of the big companies, pet food, who's that? The science?
No, yeah.
Hills.
Science Diet.
Yeah, the Hills. Yeah. But not very many merchants. I mean, that was something that Robert's Jewelers has, and I can't remember whose name it is on the outside, but if you look, it's a very ornate front window.
Marks,
that's right. There were far more Jewish merchants years ago, but not so, you know, really not so much now.
You're talking about downtown Marks? Marks? That's the fourth oldest business in Kansas. Something like that.
Is it really?
Or in the oldest jewelry store.
Yeah, and Litwin's used to be downtown. That was like a little Weaver's. They sold a lot of jeans. Who else? Sunflower was owned by a Jewish family. There's an interesting Jewish family in the theater in
Liberty Hall.
Who else? oh, the car dealership, he doesn't live here in town, Miles from Crown Auto. So, but and he lives kind of between here and Kansas City, so he is not really a member of the community, but works here.
Well,
and the money, we kind of have been going from hand to mouth. We have gotten grants from Kansas City foundations. There's Jewish Heritage Foundation have given us grants to do things with children in religious school, like money for busing and programming and taking them other places. And then the Federation has given us some funding. We got funding to do some strategic planning with a consultant. That was really to get us moving so that we didn't keep asking them for money for ongoing expenses. We'd like to grow the community. And there are people in the community who don't participate and are not affiliated. But who knows why? I don't, it's just a decision that they've made or whatever their life experience has been that they choose not to be a part of that community.
Well, there, in the United States as a whole, I think there are an awful lot of secular Jews, aren't there? People who are conscious of being Jewish, maybe give it a little bit of lip service in some way, but really are not.
Are not in a religious sense.
Yeah.
They like Jewish food, or they've got, there's an element of kind of the social network stuff and the kind of public service. There are people in the community who would never come to services, but will come if we do a program that has to do with, what's the term I'm thinking of? Well, tikkun olam, it's repairing the world. You know, it's things that we do to improve the world or help, social service kinds of things. And they will come to programs that are more intellectually based or socially based, but not religious. They don't even come to food things. You know, and then there are people who will come to food things, but not other things. And there are some people who just don't acknowledge their Judaism at all. But you're right. There are a lot of secular Jews.
I mean, I know quite a few.
Oh,
so.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. And I don't know. Do you get secular Christians in or secular Catholics? You can't really do that.
It doesn't work the same. Yeah, it's not the same. I mean, there are people that are, you might call them fallen away or something, but it's.
Yeah, it's not exactly the same. With being Jewish, so much has to do with the rituals and the cultural aspects that you can certainly be Jewish and celebrate the Sabbath and do all kinds of the holidays and all those kinds of things and not consider yourself particularly religious. Or you can you don't necessarily have to believe in God to participate in the religion fully. So you get this very broad range of ideas and beliefs and backgrounds, which is different from other religions because it's sort of in some ways beyond the religion because there's so many cultural and traditional kinds of things that take place. Like there's a rabbi in town, Salman, Salman,
yeah.
Who's a Chabad rabbi, and he's ultra-Orthodox, which means he would not have dairy products in my home, even if I had dairy products that were kosher, because he has to have, they have to be more kosher. I can't even get into it, but he says, I know it's crazy. He acknowledges it. He said, but if there's a dairy where I can get this kind, then I feel obligated to only have that. If it didn't exist, then I would have it. So they're just these funny kind of different levels. But he talks about, you know, holidays is, and it's something that my family has embraced more as we've gotten older, is the idea of celebrating the Sabbath and not working and not doing the things that you do on an everyday basis. So it might be different from what Zalman would do. He really would not do anything. We might work in the garden, but it might be because we find that a pleasurable, enjoyable thing to do, and we would spend time doing that. But we've made choices, for instance, not to go shopping. Friday nights, we don't go to social events or cultural events. And there's so much that goes on Friday nights. You know, like, we don't go to the Lead Center on Friday night. And the reason for it is that if you start doing it, then you don't have anything left because there's so much going on. So we made the decision very consciously that we will not do these things on Friday nights, and that sometimes we go to services and sometimes we don't, but we always have a special dinner, we always have company, and we sit and we talk about issues and things, and it is our way of celebrating the Shabbat. And it's really nice to take a day and have it like it used to be. You know, back when we were growing up, you couldn't go to the store on Sunday. Nothing was open. So people went to church on Sunday and went out to eat afterwards, and that was, Sunday was really a family day. And you didn't, you had a day where everything wasn't the same. And now we're 24/7. Nobody seems to take that time to recognize that it is a day that should be set aside for something different. You know, so if it's Sunday or it's Saturday, that has to do with your religious beliefs. But it really is nice to take that day. And we find that we have come to enjoy it and miss it if we don't do it. So like last weekend we were out of town and we've had company this fall. So, you know, I really feel worn out because I haven't been taking those days. And it's, somebody said that I would be observant in that way 20 years ago. I'd say, oh, that's ridiculous. But you should try it. I mean, really, it makes a huge difference. And of course, if you have a community of people who are doing it with you, then it's easier and in some ways nicer. But there are very few families here in town that actually do that, like, you know, like we do it, or even more so. You know, some people don't turn on the lights and they don't. They won't light a fire, they won't turn on the stove. So there are things you do, like leaving the oven on so you can keep your food hot, you know, at a low temperature, leaving some lights on and not turning them off. Or you have somebody who's not Jewish come in, which is really what Zalman has to do, because he has lots of students come for dinners on Friday nights and lunches on Saturday, and they really do a lot of Sabbath entertaining and holiday entertaining and engaging students. And in order to do that and be able to clean up afterwards and do some of the things they need to do, they have someone who's hired to come in and help them do those things. Or it would be almost impossible for him to do that.
That leads me to ask a question about observance. We have one synagogue. Is synagogue the proper word, Jewish Community Center?
Well,
I've always wondered.
I know. We debate about changing our name periodically because, for whatever reason, the initial group called it the Jewish Community Center. By today's sense, I mean, if you say Jewish Community Center, you think about a place that has meeting rooms and pools and athletic kinds of things, and it's not a place for religion. It's really a place for other activities. So we operate more like a synagogue than a a community center.
Well, that's what I thought, really.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, but there's only one in Lawrence.
Mm-hmm.
So I know there are Orthodox Jews in Lawrence, and there are some mm-hmm. pretty left-wing Reform Jews and conservative and everything in between.
What do we do?
So yeah, how do you cope with that spread?
You know, we try to be a little of everything. And you know, we were probably the only congregation that has like multiple prayer books. We have prayer books.
Huh.
Oh, I had said recently that we had three or four, and then the president of the congregation has said, "Oh no, we've got more than that now." We must have at least five prayer books. We have the traditional kind of conservative prayer book. We have Reform prayer books. We have Reform prayer books that are sensitive to gender, because that becomes an issue. We have, I don't know, there's, we've got a variety of prayer books, believe me. If anybody wanted to come in and do services, they could do any kind of service they wanted based on the prayer books that we have in the building. The Orthodox, we don't have a really kosher kitchen, but we don't allow meat in unless it is kosher. So that if we had a kosher kitchen, we would really separate meat and milk and have two sinks and we have multiple sinks, but we just don't. We don't have enough people who would know how to keep it on an ongoing basis because so many people use the kitchen. But we don't allow, like, pepperoni pizza in the building. So that would be, and if somebody brings in meat, it needs to be kosher.
That's which is not too easy to come by in Lawrence, is it?
No, you can't get it in Lawrence. Yeah. But you can go to Kansas City and get it. So, you know, people go into Kansas City. The change in the last few years is the fact that we had this Chabad rabbi that moved to town. And for a while, he had the Merck and at another time, Hy-Vee carrying kosher chickens, which was nice to have it here in town. They're about twice as expensive as you can get them for in Kansas City, but it was nice to at least know that you didn't need to go to Kansas City if you wanted one. So, but they didn't sell them. They didn't sell enough fast enough to make it worthwhile, which is a bit of an issue. Kosher meat is like halal meat for Muslims, and Muslims would eat kosher meat, I think. Or in certain cases, I know individuals who have said that they can do that because it's of the way in which the animal is slaughtered. But people who are, you know, if you're really Orthodox, I would think it's hard to be living here because you don't have a community to operate with. Yet the Chabad rabbi said he had a one-way ticket and he came here. And his kids will not go to public school. They will probably go into Kansas City, and there is a Chabad. There are actually now two other Chabads in Kansas City. One is run by, there's an older man, and his son now is more involved. Another young couple, cousins of Zalman's, who have one close to the plaza. And then there's the one here. And really, I mean, he came because there is a community of students who will benefit from having him here. He has a mikitza, which, do you know what that is? Men and women in an Orthodox synagogue don't sit next to each other. They sit on separate sides, or the women are behind a screen, or some synagogues, they are upstairs, like in a balcony, and the men sit downstairs. And he sets up fake plants and, you know, has a row of trees in the room where he has services, and the women are on one side and the men are on the other. He's not so overly sticky about it that he puts people off. You know, I mean, he moves from side to side so that the women don't feel left, you know, behind a wall. and goes back and forth. But he keeps a kosher home. They have, you know, one kitchen that is a meat kitchen and a kitchen that is for dairy. But it's different if you grow up in that atmosphere. And he and his wife grew up in that kind of an environment, and it is the way it is. And they don't really question it. They are kind of embedded in that kind of a lifestyle. And it is something that I would think makes it easier if you grow up like that. And it really becomes part of you, although some people have left that because they find it too confining. But it's, you kind of know what to do in all the situations, you know, and you are living it. He does not by any means push people or expect anything. He just welcomes everybody into his home and wants to make all of those activities joyous and fun. And he does a good job of it. Yeah.
And I wondered, in that regard, does he constitute competition, really? Mm-hmm. He's drawing a lot of college students down to his program, I think.
But we never had college students. Huh. I mean, we did, a really long, I mean, maybe 25, 30 years ago. We had students who would come to us, but it was back when the Hillel was not so well developed, you know, just a kind of small club, so to speak. So we never really had students except for high holidays, and we provide services, and so then students will come to us. He's drawing students in, but he hasn't drawn away from the Hillel students. So Hillel does Shabbat dinners, and Chabad does Shabbat dinners. Kids from Hillel go to Shabbat at Chabad. There's a lot of mixing, and the rabbi and the director of Hillel try to do some things together, which makes it, they don't see each other as competition, and I don't see any of it as competition as much as offering more opportunities to participate in different ways to different students. And everybody's looking for something a little bit different. And by having Chabad, it enriches, I think, the whole community. Because he does do celebrations that we don't do at the Jewish Community Center. And he's drawing a whole different group of people. There are people who think he is competition.
What about the choice of just atheism to Zoroastrianism instead of pick from this?
I'm not sure I understand.
There's a lot more choices out there for all of us.
And this is just another choice that we didn't have available in the past. And, you know, I'm very active in the Jewish Community Center. I kind of spent my whole adult life involved with it, and yet I have a relationship with the rabbi and his wife, and I go to things at their home, and I don't think it takes away from what I do at the center. There are a number of families who do both at different times for different reasons, and there are some that would not step into the Chabad at all. I have a friend who said to me, any man who won't shake my hand, I don't need to have anything to do with them. So, and very religious Orthodox men don't touch women other than their wives and their kids, you know, and children don't count in the same way. Likewise, the wives don't touch other men. They don't dance. Men and women don't dance together at affairs or weddings and things. Women dance together and the men dance together. That's just the way they do it. You know, that he won't shake my hand doesn't bother me a whole lot. I understand where it's coming from, and So he doesn't shake my hand. I have to be careful that I don't give him hugs. So, because my instinct when I greet him, because I've gotten to know him, is to greet him with a hug, and I have to kind of pull myself back. And that's true for other people too. But he's good about it. He puts his hands together and takes a step back, and you know, protects himself. But yeah, these are just, you know, certain beliefs. It's just. Yeah.
What is Israel? What is Israel like?
Well, I'll say, when we were, we took the family to Israel when the kids were younger, and the difference there is that everybody's on your calendar. You know, things shut down on Friday afternoon because everybody's getting ready for Shabbat. Nothing's open on Saturday because it is Shabbat, but they go to school on Sundays. And so you have it's a different kind of a calendar, different kind of a feeling. And it's pretty amazing to go from this to that and experience it. And I think, you know, it's kind of a important thing for people to do at some point in their lives is to visit and see what that is like.
Say about America when they come, Israelis come here, do they?
Well, you know, a lot of Israelis are very secular.
Okay.
So I don't think it's such a huge change for them to come here. I would say the majority of Israelis that I've known who have lived in Lawrence for various reasons were much more secular and less religious than American Jews, just as a whole. That's not to say there isn't a huge number of very ultra-Orthodox religious groups in Israel, where, you know, they will come at you and stone you if you're walking in their area and you're not dressed appropriately. Like if you have a miniskirt and bare arms, they would not want you in their little community.
They don't have signs or anything, though. Red or blue, or it's like games.
No. You know when you're going into that particular neighborhood.
Don't go.
And there are signs on the outside. No, you can go. You can certainly go, but you. It's kind of like if you're visiting a Muslim country. If you show respect and wear a head covering, or you go into churches in Europe, there are lots of churches where you don't go in if you don't have your arms covered and, you know, your knees covered, or you take a shawl or something to put over you if you're not dressed appropriately. So I think that's kind of a standard religious sort of thing if you go into any...
Well, different people have different practices.
But that's a similar one across religions,
right.
I think.
Yeah. Let me ask, this actually in a way relates to the money question, but is there a rabbi now at the community center?
In our community center, no.
There has been, I think, hasn't there?
We really have tried, but no, we don't have a rabbi. And you know what? We went through part-time rabbis for the last maybe 10 years or something. And I almost wish that rabbis were assigned like priests are. Because, you know, you get someone and that's your priest. And if you don't like him, that's too bad. But he stays in your congregation until the church moves him. And I'm sure people feel badly when they get to know someone and then they leave. Like the, what was his name? The priest down at St. John's. And we had gotten to know him through friends. And we went.
Father John?
Was he the older man who left recently in the last couple of
John
years?
Schmiedler or something. Was
but he.
Father.
I remember we went for a christening or something, and says, "And our Jewish friends are here today." And we're like, "Ooh." but the rabbi thing is hard. First, they're very expensive. I mean, pay their salary, you pay their benefits and you pay their whatever, organizational fees and all of those things. Rabbis just getting out of school now make more than 80,000, somewhere between 80 and 100. If you get somebody with some experience, they make very good salaries. We've always been in a position that if we hear about someone who doesn't have a job who's in Kansas City and is willing to come and work part-time or wants a part-time job but doesn't want a congregation full-time, well, think about that. If they don't have a job, why don't they have a job? Probably because they're not the best rabbis in the world. And, you know, in one case, it was a young woman who had young children, and she really didn't want a full-time position at that point in her life. But it's really hard to find somebody who has a commitment to the community. So you get someone who comes in, and it's like an itinerant. They don't get to know you. They just come and do their thing and leave. And it's not a good experience. It's not real positive. And then there's always the case of, you know, somebody hates this rabbi and loves that rabbi, and the whole congregation will never agree, but that's true across the board. I mean, I listened to friends in Kansas City one time, and I thought, oh, it's just like here, except they have full-time rabbis, and then they fire them when they don't like them. But, it's not very secure in some situations, but at the moment, we don't have a rabbi. We have a fairly well-educated lay community, and we do services ourselves. And even when we had a rabbi, sometimes we liked our services better than the ones that they provided, which made it hard on the rabbi, and we were, you know, we just did it anyway. So it's not like we have lost anything. It would be nice to have somebody for life cycle events and Zalman to some extent, the rabbi at Chabad. He has done a number of funerals recently, unfortunately, too many of them, but he has stepped in and done some of these kind of life cycle services. But he doesn't do it as a representative of our community. He does it when individuals ask for him to perform a particular service. And you don't have to have a rabbi.
Right.
I mean, to have service, it's not a requirement by any means.
This is Phil Anderson from the Topeka Capital Journal.
Oh, gosh.
Coming in to check us out.
you don't need to have the only stipulation is that you have the 10 people, 10 men for the Orthodox, and some conservative congregations still kind of go back and forth. Depends on the congregation. But some are more more observant in that way or not observant, but more traditional in that sense. But any of the Reform congregations, men and women count equally. And women can be called up to the Torah. In an Orthodox synagogue, you wouldn't have that. Women do not get called up to the front to do anything. It's all men.
I was going to ask you about that here. I mean, given, again, this spread that there is in Lawrence, was that a struggle? I know today it's pretty egalitarian. Women they make up the minion and so forth, but I suspect that wasn't always true, probably, was it?
No.
And
There were times like when my generation came, came in, or when as young adults or young families, when we joined the congregation, our expectations were different, but we'd gone through the whole women's movement kind of thing. And so, there were people who were much more traditional. And in fact, Herman Cohn, who was one of the original members of the congregation, really couldn't stand the thought of having women up on the Bima.
Really?
It really troubled him. He did not like it. it was, wasn't in his tradition at all to have women there. So it was disturbing for him to have that. Now, you know, he came along eventually. But that was one thing that wasn't going to be able to stay traditional in this congregation.
I can't imagine in Lawrence that that could last.
Yeah, that wasn't going to last a long time. But we have had struggles with, you know, the idea of being traditional or more reform, you know, less traditional, with joining a joining an organization that, like one, like either the Reform congregations or the conservative Orthodox wouldn't take us because we're too all over the place. But our congregation's never been able to join one of those kind of umbrella organizations. And we don't necessarily need a rabbi to join. If a rabbi, if we had a full-time rabbi, we would have to affiliate with one of those groups because there are benefits to the rabbi that they wouldn't get if we didn't join, and they, we probably couldn't get someone full-time. But that's been a struggle because people who are more traditional will refuse to accept membership in the Reform congregations, and that really is where the bulk of our congregants are anymore. And it makes the most sense for the way our congregation is, but those people, and I remember conversations and meetings about that, wouldn't hear of it. They said they would leave the congregation if that was done, so we've never joined anything.
So you're making it sound like the center of gravity is Reform. Really, I've always pictured it closer to conservative.
Well, I say that because that would be the place where we would go. That doesn't mean that the whole... I would not consider myself Reform.
Okay.
You know, but I would... And maybe I should back up and explain that a little bit. What that joining and affiliating with one of those groups does is that it gives you resources that you can't get elsewhere. And educational resources, speakers who will come to the congregation, educational stuff that we don't get. There are organizations for young people and for teens that one of the organizations, I guess it was the Reform one, allowed us to participate for a period of time. And then they said, well, look, you're not affiliating, so your kids can't come anymore. So it meant that our teens don't have some group that they can do things with and participate in that way. I really wanted that for our kids. So I would have said, even though I don't consider myself Reform, my feeling was, okay, let's join the Reform. We get a lot of benefits, and the children will benefit. But some people couldn't see past their noses and said, no. And you know, the funny thing is that it wouldn't have mattered to them because nothing else would have changed. We would have gotten more, but our services wouldn't have changed, and what our beliefs wouldn't change, and nobody was going to tell us to do things differently. It's just an association that some of us saw to be beneficial to a good portion of the congregation and certainly the young people. So it's a... But that's still... I would imagine if we brought that up, we'd still have a few people who... I don't think we're going to bring it up for a while.
Yeah. Well, I should, I don't know, you've been sitting on the griddle for a while here.
Well, I don't know if the students have any questions.
Yeah,
if you have questions.
Do you have questions you want to ask?
No questions.
I've always got something. I kind of realize what I am. I just coined this term, a secular bigot.
Secular bigot? I don't like the sound of that.
Well, it's just, I think, telling little kids that you're this and you're that and you're this and you're that, and you're labeling them. And they don't really get a chance to discover who or what they are. You know, you're supposed to go to this building on Saturday. You go to this building on Sunday. You put this on when you go into church. You got to take that off when you go to church. And I mean, do we really have a choice on what we want to believe and do and think when we grow up? Because when you were sitting in your 20s and you didn't go except maybe on high holidays, mm-hmm. you were kind of, it seemed to me, I don't know the word seeking, but you were out of that hole a little bit. And we read a lot, like Iliade, or, yeah, Return to the Eternal, where people want to go back to their roots, whatever they are. But what my question is to you, or to these little kids, is if you weren't told what you were and where you're from and what you should do, who would you be? What would you be?
Well, that's a really big question.
Yeah, that's
a, that is maybe more than
cosmic. Yeah.
But
yeah.
I guess in response to that is that you know, we don't, our kids need nurturing for a period of time before they can go out on their own. They can't live on their own. If the kids could be out there on their own, then they would make choices for themselves. They might not be such good choices. So you have parents or guardians of some sort who guide those children. So what you're saying is like people shouldn't tell them what to do or where to go.
No way. So, no way at all. I'm saying you search, you nurture them. You can teach them how to start fires in the forest or hunt or do everything else, but tell them that
you're no belief system.
Yeah, you got to worship this God on this day. No, you got to nurture them and love them.
So that would be your choice if you had children, not to instill a belief system.
A moral system that's specific to one creed or culture.
Well, so you would choose whatever you did.
Well,
see, and the choices I would make would be different than the choices you would make, and you would make different choices. But I think I would never have thought of it as saying, you know, putting them in a box and saying you're this, you're this, you're this. I mean, you're part of that family that participates in something or doesn't. And so you learn to do that. I've seen kids who grew up in a family with two Jewish parents, but the parents didn't do anything. So when the kids got a little bit older, they didn't know what they were. It, you know, they didn't have anything to, you know. And then you're in school in a community like Lawrence, and most of the people you're going to be in class with are not Jewish. And then you go home, you don't know anything about what they're talking about, and you don't have something to balance it off. And I think that's not necessarily a good place for kids to be.
No.
And if you, you know, I think when young people go off to college is a time when they're mature enough to start thinking on their own about those choices and realize that they might agree with their parents or not agree with their parents, that they might they're more likely to be having opportunities to explore a variety of beliefs. You know, even just in classes, you know, you guys are taking classes in the School of Religion. You're having the opportunity to study these other belief systems. You might find one that suits you better. So I think that it's at that age where young people really do have some opportunity to make choices and think things through for themselves and decide what's right for them or not.
College is kind of late. I'd say Montessori would be a little better.
No. Does anyone else have any questions you want to ask about Judaism?
I always get wrong.
Association with Kansas City a lot. What about the group in Topeka, the synagogue in Topeka?
Oh,
I'm just curious if it goes that direction.
It does somewhat. I think more about Kansas City because there are so many synagogues there.
Sure. Yeah.
And I have friends in Kansas City, and I don't really know a lot of people in Topeka. Mm-hmm. So my sense is that I think about Kansas City.
Sure.
And they're, you know, Topeka's having the same problems we are. Mm-hmm. They're financially in a better place because they had an endowment that was set up by someone. And that's kept them sort of ahead of the game. We never had an endowment. And as I say, we never had anybody with really deep pockets either. So financially, they're in a different place. But they do have a rabbi, and we had the same rabbi part-time And then she took a position there, to work for them part-time, and then took a full-time position there. And we do some things because we know the rabbi, and the religious school will do things together. And we sometimes have services, but be honest with you, I don't want to go to Topeka to go to services on Friday night. I mean, that's me. I mean, I just don't want to do that. So I never have gone.
It'd be really hard if you were observant and didn't drive.
Oh, yeah, well, that's an issue, too. Yeah, that's an issue. But there are congregations in Kansas City that are Orthodox, and everyone lives in the neighborhood, so they don't have to walk. And then it's a whole different setting. You have services earlier in the evening on Friday, and that way you can go to services and still come home and have dinner and not have to run out of the house after dinner and go to services. And then they go to Saturday morning services, and then people get together and have lunch, and some synagogues have lunch following services. But I would say Orthodox communities on the whole, people go back and have lunch at someone's house, and it's kind of a relaxing social time. Then they go home and take naps, and you know, but the kids have other kids to play with who can do the same sort of things or not do the same sort of things, so it makes it a little bit easier. We had friends who were extremely hard on their kids when they were adolescents, and they, you know, they weren't allowed to do this, that, and the other thing. They kept kosher, and they couldn't eat lunch at school, and they couldn't buy anything in the store. The daughter seemed to get by just fine, never seemed to have much of an effect, but the son really had a hard time with it. I mean, you know, came Saturday, and he wanted to do things with his friends, and he had to stay, you know, he had a lot of restrictions. But if he lived in a community where there were other people that he was with, and his friends were doing the same thing, it makes it much easier. And really, it's more pleasant to have other people to do these things with.
Well, do you have any last pearls of wisdom you want to leave us with?
Oh, I don't know. I got this very interesting little email from, did you know Steve Shaw?
Yeah.
This is a friend who retired and is living in Arizona, and he sent a little, little video thing through email. His synagogue is celebrating its 100th year in Arizona. It was the first synagogue to be built in Arizona, and it was before Arizona was a state. It was still a territory when it was built. And it's a beautiful building. You know, they showed the old building and then the new building, and the new building has recently had some work done. And this is where they now go. And he said he still misses us. But it's interesting because there are those synagogues that have been around for so long in places that you don't necessarily expect. Gosh,
Tucson must have been a little dusty crossroads village.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. Yeah, but I don't. I can't think of something else that would be really important, unless there's some aspect or some piece that I left out.
Yeah, there's a thousand pieces that we didn't get to. But
New York. How has that changed?
How is New York changed? Well, I don't live there anymore, so I don't know. I mean, I just visit.
But how did the, well, I guess it's a stereotype that they have a lot of neighborhoods.
The neighborhoods move. We went to visit the Tenement Museum in downtown.
Tenement Museum, wow.
Yeah, there's a Tenement Museum. There are some buildings down in this area that literally have not been touched, which is amazing that somebody didn't get hold of them. But the years when the Jews lived in those tenements, it just is a revolving door for new immigrants. So you have different immigrants, but there's still an immigrant population. It just keeps changing, which is kind of interesting because the people who who gave the tour were not necessarily Jewish, and some were from other countries, and they talked about that as these different immigrant groups coming into this country, and many of them obviously starting in New York. Yeah, it's very interesting. And you know, these neighborhoods, they're all changing. But they're changing here, and they're changing Kansas City. Selma, who I keep talking about, she's a big part of my life here. She grew up somewhere downtown Kansas City. She would tell stories about how she would walk to the market with her grandfather, and they would do things. And it's not an area where any of us would necessarily want to live now. And so, you know, the communities change and shift and move around in cities, and I think that's true everywhere.
Well, thanks for coming in.
Oh, well, you're welcome. This was fun.